Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's guest speakers will be Attorney Gene Burke and Dr. Karen Lisko, the directors of the Nebraska Innocence Project. The topic of their presentation will be the Beatrice Six. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, May 21st, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Dale Munson, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Quoting from a copyrighted story in the Omaha World Herald of January 26, 2009, by reporter Lynn Sofranik. Joseph White had a lot of explaining to do. Pulled from his home in Holly Pond, Alabama, in 1989, White was faced with heavy questioning by a Gage County, Nebraska deputy about the rape and murder of a 68-year-old Beatrice woman 4 years earlier. The deputy told White he had an awful damn good proof that White was the killer. But White didn't know what there was to explain. Anything he knew about the homicide was based on gossip he had heard at the R&S Bar, his favorite watering hole, during the 4 months that he lived in Beatrice. So White decided to let his blood do the talking. "You know that could positively identify you, right?" the deputy asked. "You know that?" "Yep," said White. "And it can also positively prove I wasn't there." But it did not, even though DNA tests last year did. End of quote. Joseph White was one of the so-called Beatrice Six, wrongfully convicted and imprisoned some 5 years, some for five, some for up to 19 years for the 1985 murder of Helen Wilson. Although all six have now been cleared and released from prison, they are in the midst of difficult assimilation back into society. And at this point, there has been no compensation paid by the state of Nebraska for their false imprisonment. Here to discuss the plight of the Beatrice Six and the status and ramifications of legislative efforts to compensate these six people are two directors of the Nebraska Innocence Project. So please welcome Gene Burke, an attorney at law, and Dr. Karen Lisko, senior litigation consultant.
Well, when a crime happens, it's usually pretty clear who the victim is or who the victims are. But in a minority of cases, it's not always so clear. And in this case in particular, with the Beatrice Six and several hundred across the country, there are victims within the criminal justice system whose voices are now just starting to be heard. We're going to tell you some about the Beatrice Six. We're also going to talk to you in a more broad perspective about the work of the National Innocence Project and the Nebraska Innocence Project, whose mission is to help exonerate those who are indeed innocent of crimes where they have been convicted. So the goal is to try to exonerate those people. Now, I want to show you just a brief moment of a video clip of one of the six of the Beatrice Six. His name is Thomas Winslow. And what you'll see context-wise and hear context-wise is this gentleman talking in support of Legislative Bill 260. And if you recall that bill, it was intended to try to get some kind of compensation for those who have been wrongfully convicted in the state of Nebraska and try to get them back on their life path so that they have an opportunity to get assimilated back into society. So listen to what Thomas Winslow has to say in support of that.
My name is Thomas Winslow. I am currently one of the inmates released from prison for the brutal murder of 1985, murder of Helen Wilson. I was exonerated due to the DNA testing stating that I was wrongly convicted of this crime. During my time in prison, I went through so many different things. I could sit here and explain to you horrific things that go on in the prison system. But that's not what I'm here to do today. What I'm here to do today is to share with you why I feel this bill is important. Due to my wrongful conviction, 20 years of my life was taken for no reason. I can't get those 20 years back. All I can do is try to rebuild my life now. I have got a job. It's not a great job. It's a job with no health insurance. It's a job that barely makes the rent. But I do, and I make it. But I know it's a job that I cannot spend the rest of my life at. I don't have Social Security. I don't have a retirement fund. 20 years of a blank history between the time I went into prison to the time I released. I have nothing. All I have is what I build today.
So, this, in fact, is a victim of the criminal justice system who was wrongfully convicted. Again, a minority of those who are convicted. Most who get convicted deserve to be in prison and serving the sentences that they are serving. But in this case, as you'll hear, the Beatrice Six went through quite an arduous journey. And luckily, things have changed for them at this point. But we know for a fact that there are others who are in the prison system still to this day throughout the United States who don't belong there. So we want to cover with you five questions. And these questions go along the who, what, when, where, and why, specifically the who's, the whys, and the what's. And we'll start with, who are the wrongfully convicted? Who are the Beatrice Six? Why do wrongful convictions occur? What happened to the Beatrice Six? And what remedies are needed? So this gives us an opportunity to educate you not just about the Beatrice Six, but about the reform that's going on throughout the United States in general as well. So let's go to the first one. Who are the wrongfully convicted? Now, there's information collected by the National Innocence Project, formed by Barry Scheck, seated in New York, that looks at the profile of those who have been exonerated. To date, as of today, there have been 238 post-conviction DNA exonerations in the United States. People whose innocence has been proven because of DNA evidence that has either been later analyzed or has been lost and then found, or that's been used at a later point collected from the victim. Interestingly, 17 of those folks served time on death row before they were exonerated. So these are people who were innocent who knew they were facing death. Racially, it's interesting to see, and this becomes very important when we talk about reforms, that the vast majority are African American who have been wrongfully convicted, followed by Caucasians, Latinos, Asian Americans, and a few whose race is unknown. And they're pretty young. Average age, 26 years old. Most are male, and the vast majority are poor. Very few have privately retained attorneys, but have had attorneys who have been assigned to them. So who are the Beatrice Six?
Well, the Beatrice Six are six individuals, starting with Mr. Joseph White. Mr. Joseph White was born and raised down in Alabama, and he was in the Army. We know that. We had graduated from high school. He then traveled, after he was discharged to the Army, he traveled to California. In California, he was in the Los Angeles, Hollywood area, and he met up with Ada Joanne Taylor, second person of the Beatrice Six. They became friends, and together, in 1985, they traveled to Nebraska to Beatrice because Ada Joanne Taylor had a daughter living in Beatrice. They in turn then met a third person, Thomas Winslow, whose video clip you heard. They befriended Thomas. Sometimes they stayed at Tom's apartment. At the time, Tom had a girlfriend who he later married by the name of Beth Winslow. The four of them hung around together, did things together. Ada Joanne Taylor also knew several others. She knew two women by the name of Kathy Gonzalez and also knew Deborah Sheldon. Thomas Winslow also had dealings with both Thomas and Clifford Sheldon. So the six together were loosely associated, some closer than others. They all had met each other with the exception, I believe Joe White said that he had never met Deb Sheldon. Next question is, why do wrongful convictions occur?
Now, there's been some really interesting social science research that has looked at the common leading causes for how this happens and how it happens repeatedly. And we're going to talk about these in more detail, but there are six leading causes of wrongful convictions, starting with the most common, and that is with mistaken eyewitness identification. Now, these may be people who are very intent and sincere in who they've identified, who may have no malevolent feelings at all about who they're identifying. It just may be that they believe that's who the perpetrator was, but they turn out to be wrong about that. We'll talk about why that happens in a few minutes. Then false confessions, untruthful testimony from informants is the third. Fourth is poor forensic work. Fifth is government misconduct, both either through police or through the prosecutors. And then sixth, unfortunately, at times, bad lawyering. Now, the good news about this is in the minority of cases. In the vast majority of cases, in criminal defense and in criminal prosecution, good work is done, the right person is found to be guilty, and that person is dealt with. But these kinds of patterns that have occurred within these six happen enough that it does cause a troubling trend. So what happened to the Beatrice Six in particular?
There are four primary causes for the wrongful conviction of the Beatrice Six. The first was a forensic error, and that was occurred in 1985 when the blood sample was originally taken to the Nebraska State Crime Patrol Lab. They actually took blood samples and determined that the victim's blood was an O, that was Helen Wilson's, and that the perpetrator, they believed, had a type B non-secretor classification for that blood type. Shortly after the lab work was done, a person came forward by the name of Mike Hyatt and said that he had dropped an individual by the name of Bruce Allen Smith off near the apartment, very close in time to the murder. And others that had seen Bruce Allen Smith the following morning noticed that he had marks and scrapes on his face and he had looked disheveled, etc. So the Beatrice Police Department did a fine job. They followed Mr. Smith. He had, in fact, taken a bus from Beatrice to Topeka. He lived in Oklahoma City, but he didn't have enough money to get all the way back. Eventually, he got back to Oklahoma City, and the Beatrice Police Department went down, took his forensic samples, took blood, saliva, hair, etc. Unfortunately, they didn't bring it home to have it analyzed. They brought it to the Oklahoma City Police Crime Lab where the first error occurred. The blood type was noted to be type B, but it was shown that in error that he was a secretor. So at that time, because that was Joyce Gilchrist who did the forensic work in the Oklahoma City lab, they dismissed Bruce Allen Smith as a suspect. So that was the first error. The second error to occur was questionable investigative techniques. If you followed the stories, and there's just been excellent journalism done by Paul Hamill, Lynn Sofronik, also Joe Duggan and Catherine Huddle, you've heard a lot about the techniques that were used. Many of them were questionable. Many of them included showing suspects photos and video of the crime scene, bringing the accomplices to the crime scene to see the evidence, threatening use of the death penalty for several of the accomplices, and also offering them severely reduced charges and reduced sentence in exchange for their agreeing. Another problem with the case involved unreliable informants. When investigator Searcy, acting as a private individual first, decided that he wanted to investigate the case on his own time as a private investigator, he found a woman by the name of Lisa Brown. Lisa Brown told him, this was within a couple months of the murder occurring, that on the day that Helen Wilson's body was found, that a woman by the name of Ada Joanne Taylor confessed to her that she knew about the murder and that she had been there during the murder and that she had not been there alone. She had been there with someone by the name of Lobo. Now, what was known at the time and also later verified was that this Lisa Brown had an intense dislike and hatred of Ada Joanne Taylor. They did not get along. There were police reports that indicated there had been fighting animosity between the two. The other unreliable informant was Clifford Sheldon. If you know the story, you know that after Helen Wilson was murdered in 1987, I believe, Cliff Sheldon and Thomas Winslow committed a robbery together, and they committed a robbery of a Lincoln motel. At the time, Thomas Winslow told me that they agreed that they would rob the motel clerk, and that was the agreement, that Tom would try to work with the motel clerk to get his attention diverted, and that Cliff Sheldon would actually commit the robbery. Well, as it turned out, Cliff Sheldon began to brutally beat the motel clerk. And Mr. Winslow's statements is that he had never agreed to the brutal assault. Anyway, they were both charged with robbery and assault. And while in prison, Cliff Sheldon, in an exchange to try to get a deal with the prosecutor for reduced charges and to be let out early, told Bert Searcy, the investigator, that he knew that Ada Joanne Taylor, Joe White, Tom Winslow, and Tom Winslow's girlfriend were involved in the Helen Wilson murder. Okay. Again, similar with Lisa Brown, there's deep animosity between Clifford Sheldon and Tom Winslow, and so very unreliable. And the last were some of the tactics used by Gage County District Attorney Richard Smith. None of these were illegal. They're used today, and they're perfectly legal. But we do know that by offering the accomplice witnesses substantially reduced sentences, it was a great incentive for them to fabricate element. They were saving their hides by agreeing to a story that was largely manufactured and fabricated by the investigators and detectives. They were saving themselves from possible death penalty, and they were looking out for their own interests.
So, in terms of knowing what to do looking forward, I mean, we look back at what happened with the Beatrice Six, and fortunately they've been exonerated, but the key is to know, what do we take from that? And what do we take from understanding those six leading causes of why wrongful convictions occur? Because they've been identified so clearly and aptly, it allows us to look at the steps that need to happen to try to prevent these kinds of victimizations of folks from occurring. You might recall the first thing that I mentioned was mistaken eyewitness identification. In 77% of cases that became exonerations, 77%, it was because of mistaken eyewitness identification. Now, this is different from informants who have a grudge. These may well be the vast majority of people who truly thought they were identifying the correct perpetrator, but they got it wrong. So the question is, how? How could they get it wrong? One of the biggest things is, remember what I said about the fact that the majority are African American. The reason that's important is because in a large amount of those cases, a person of a different race identified the African American incorrectly as being the perpetrator. Now, this is not just isolated to African Americans, but there is a lot of research that we know of as social scientists in the literature about the fact of something called transracial misidentification, where we can all be guilty of this. I'm a Caucasian. I would probably be less reliable in identifying somebody who was African American if I'm not of that race. Just like someone who's African American may have more trouble identifying someone who's Asian. So again, it's not just isolated to one race or the other. But the fact of the matter is, our research finds that people who are not of the same race often too generally and too broadly look at another race as being too similar in appearance. So mistakes happen. There's more of an identification of that person was an Asian, that's the perpetrator, as opposed to that person was an Asian, 5'7", of this kind of stature, this type of a nose, this color of eyes. That kind of detail often gets lost. And unfortunately, it turns into identifying the wrong person. That's one of the reasons mistaken identification occurs. You may also know, if you've covered this kind of thing in the press, in your own history, that a lot of times identification happens in a few seconds. Somebody's driving by. You get a glimpse of the person as the eyewitness. It's very, very brief. But there's often a rush to judgment of knowing we've got an eyewitness here. Let's see who that person remembers it to be. So there can be a lot of just bad information going into the short-term memory in terms of knowing who it is, who was the perpetrator. So what do we do about it? That's where the hope comes in. Knowing what the causes are, we can look at what some realistic reforms are to prevent this from happening in the future. One of them is to change protocol for lineups. It can be very subjective to put a lineup together. The lineup can be put together so that there are a lot of people who are so similar in characteristics and looks to who the police really believe to be the actual perpetrator that it can cause confusion on the part of the eyewitness when they identify that person. Another recommendation is to use something called a double-blind procedure, which means one police officer knows who the suspect is. Let's say there's five people in a lineup. The one police officer knows who the one person is who they believe to have been the perpetrator. Another police officer, blind to that, is the one who questions these folks in the lineup. So there's no suggestibility or there's no bias in how the police officer who's in the know, however unintentionally, might question those people. Try to make it as objective as possible and neutral as possible. And to prohibit show-ups. We'll go into more detail about that in a minute. But to also continue investigations after identification. Because a lot of times what happens is once you've got an eyewitness who says it's person number four, that might be the end of it, and it may be that it's too soon. There may not be enough evidence to support all of that. Now, this is a tough call. I mean, obviously, there are short resources and huge caseloads here. So the hope is to get to these kinds of reforms, even knowing that it'll be a pretty tough call to try to get all of those things in place.
Second leading cause of wrongful conviction are false confessions. They occur approximately 25% of the cases. This case involved four, maybe five false confessions, and then spilled over into false accomplice testimony at trial. In other words, they made false admissions, and then as part of their plea agreements, the Beatrice Six were required to go to trial and testify to their false admissions. The major reform, and Nebraska just last year adopted a statute requiring electronic recording of the entire custodial interrogation from beginning to end. Nebraska does limit that to serious felony offenses. But this has proven to be very important. You may know from your following of the Beatrice Six case that many of the interrogations were in fact recorded. But you also may know that at certain times the cameras were shut off, and an hour later, 2 hours later, they came back on. Okay, what was fed to the accomplice or the defendants during that hour, 2 hours, when the camera wasn't rolling, we don't know. Can only suspect that what they've done is to look at what statements and what stories were told while the camera was on, then the camera is off, comes back on, the story's very different an hour or two later than it was in the preceding segment. So it suggests that they were showing things, showing photographs, showing videos, et cetera, or showing other statements by other defendants in an attempt to get them all in line. Next one, the third cause, is the untruthful informant's testimony. In my mind, that is the critical part of the Beatrice Six case. It is the inherently unreliable accomplice testimony of Ada Joanne Taylor, of James Dean, and of Deb Sheldon that caused the wrongful conviction of Joseph White and in turn Thomas Winslow, as well as their own wrongful convictions of the informants. The major reforms. One thing that Nebraska has done, and this again was enacted last year, is to enact a jailhouse informant statute. Nebraska's statute does not go as far as other states. It is essentially a disclosure statute. And in that disclosure statute, it requires the prosecutor to turn over the background as well as the statements, et cetera, for defense counsel to look at.
Fourth cause cause is poor forensics. And again, there may be, in the vast majority of cases, excellent forensics. But forensics are done by human beings, and errors can occur, can be subjective. This is has been looked at by the National Innocence Project. And in their look at the time of just 74 exonerations that had occurred at that point, the most common problem with forensic errors was misinterpretation by somebody looking at the data, either in the lab or looking at a report after the fact, and just not getting it right. They made a mistake. So again, the reason for that could be speed at which they're looking at all of the cases, not being qualified. I mean, there could be a whole host of reasons for why that happens. But misinterpretation is the most common one, followed by some results that were intentional, falsified results for whatever reason that person who was looking at the data had a motive to come up with false data. The case of another one being that evidence was just suppressed. There was awareness on the part of someone in the investigation that evidence existed, and the evidence did not come to light. Fortunately, the number is not high, but it's enough that it affected the life of someone and put them in prison without due cause. Reform-wise, there are two that are recommended. One of them is, again, to try to get more objectivity in the system and to move crime labs out from under law enforcement management, to have more of a checks and balances so that those are two separate bodies who are either looking at the data and then interpreting it and enforcing it, as opposed to it all being merged together. And to also put, again, some kind of objective standards in place for forensic laboratories and to require that all of them be accredited. If we have someone in our family or someone we care about who is facing conviction based on this kind of data being looked at, we know we would care deeply about how well that data is looked at. And trying to put some standards into place with accreditation would hopefully help in that regard.
Moving quickly along, two more causes, government misconduct. They include the suppression of exculpatory evidence, coercing witnesses, improper closing arguments, false statements to the jury, fabricating evidence, and other misconduct. And these are usually committed by prosecutors during trials. None of these would have occurred in the Beatrice Six case. The other is police misconduct. This includes the suppression of exculpatory evidence, fabricating evidence, coercing witnesses, coercing confessions and admissions, and other misconduct. This has certainly been highlighted to have occurred in the Beatrice Six case, that there were coercive interrogations and improper interrogation techniques used. As far as reforms, primarily it's just that the prosecutors and the police departments need to be held accountable for their actions. There needs to be mandatory peer reporting, and there needs to be disciplinary action taken. And the final one is bad lawyering.
Now, most lawyers are good at lawyering, so that's a good part of the news. As a jury researcher by training, I've worked with many outstanding attorneys and know that sometimes what bad lawyering comes down to is not a desire, of course, to be a bad lawyer, but because of the caseload that someone is sharing and the fact that everybody's human. So some of the reforms that we're talking about in these cases is, especially because, you know, in criminal investigations, especially with DNA evidence, this is to some degree rocket science. So you want to be sure that the training is specific with the attorney who's dealing with these things. And the brightest and best criminal defense attorneys have that training. But to also make sure, especially for public defenders whose caseloads are so massive, that they have some kind of reprieve, some kind of relief or an opportunity not to have to face such a high caseload, so that perhaps there's even some kind of a legislative movement to get a cap on the number of cases that they've got to cover. They only have so many hours and energy in their day. To make sure that there are larger budgets. Unfortunately, a lot of things don't happen well because the money isn't there for it to happen. But also, for those who might be sloppy at times, especially when someone's life is at stake, to make sure that accountability is there. Checks and balances within the attorneys who are dealing with these kinds of cases. And to make sure that if there's an awareness within the bar of incompetence among criminal defense lawyers, among criminal prosecutors, that there's some kind of way of making sure that the institution takes care of itself in that way of mandatory reporting of incompetence with consequences, discipline, criminal charges for those who really are at their worst and who have created some very, very difficult situations and who are not just simply missing the mark because of a bad day, but rather because of being incompetent. So we've got recommended reforms to sum all of this up.
The first reform that the Nebraska Innocence Project would propose and suggest would be consideration by our state lawmakers to declare a moratorium on executions. I don't know how many of you know this, but Joseph White, when he was tried, the state tried to get the death penalty. And they went after the death penalty, and it was the judge that determined that because of the alleged contributions of Mr. Winslow and Ms. Taylor to the death of Ms. Wilson, that he should not be given the death penalty. The second is Nebraska Innocence Project would recommend that death sentences be, the current death sentences, be commuted to life without parole. We're hoping to provide easier access to post-conviction testing. Some of you may know that in 2001, former Senator Ernie Chambers was instrumental in getting the passage of the Nebraska DNA Testing Act, and that act does allow a procedure whereby inmates can file a motion, a pro se motion, in the district court where they were convicted and request DNA testing. It's much more difficult than it seems. Many, many cases are denied procedurally for certain reasons. District courts have determined that the evidence is too old, that it may be contaminated or degraded, that the trial evidence is overwhelming of guilt, et cetera, and many, many times the motions are denied. Nebraska Project would recommend is mandating preservation of biological evidence in serious felony cases. Right now, the Nebraska DNA statute requires that evidence be preserved through the time the person is incarcerated. We'd like to see that extended at least through the supervision, the parole, or the federal supervision time to allow wrongful conviction actions to occur after release. And finally, we'd like to see legislation that would impose sanctions for the intentional disposal of or corruption of evidence. Before I talk about remedial measures, just want to make sure, and maybe your question to your mind is, well, how did the six defendants get exonerated? How did that process happen? Well, it happened by Joe White always believing in his innocence. His mantra from day one was, I was not there. He told authorities over and over, told his trial counsel, I was not there. You know, he pleaded not guilty. And a year after, maybe the same year he was convicted, 1990, he first filed for DNA testing. And the county attorney at the time, Richard Smith, he moved to oppose that testing on the basis that the evidence was 5 years old, it would be degraded and contaminated, and it was denied the motion. It was never appealed. And at that time, nothing else was done until, again, 2005, Joe White, again, believing in his innocence, contacted an attorney in Norfolk, Nebraska, by the name of Doug Stratton, because he had heard that Doug Stratton had been successful with post-conviction work. Doug Stratton came down, and he tells a wonderful story that he came down to the prison to tell Joe White, thanks for your interest in me, I'd love to help you, but I'm sorry, I can't. But he sat down and he interviewed Joe, and he listened to Joe White, and he was convinced that there might be something to the case. He then went and talked to Thomas Winslow, and Mr. Stratton decided that that was the key to the case, was to have both men file motions for DNA testing. And the next thing Mr. Stratton did that was so important was to contact one of our state's premier experts in post-conviction work, who is Mr. Jerry Susie at the Nebraska Commission for Public Advocacy. And together, Mr. Stratton and Mr. Susie filed the motions necessary, went down to the district court and argued that DNA testing, if it were performed and if it excluded both men, that there would be real problems with the trial evidence and that the jury verdict couldn't stand. The attorneys were unsuccessful at the district court level. The district judge didn't buy it, said it doesn't matter, DNA testing, there's overwhelming evidence of guilt. There were three accomplices who testified to their being there. Even if one didn't commit the rape, then the other one committed the rape, didn't buy it, denied the motion. Together, the attorneys worked together to appeal to the Nebraska Supreme Court, and writing for the Supreme Court, Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman determined that the post-conviction counsel were absolutely right. DNA testing was the key, and DNA testing, if it were to exclude both men, would create great doubt on the trial evidence, the accomplice testimony, and would prove that neither men raped, then there either had to be a seventh person there or the state's case was fraudulent. So at that time, DNA testing was ordered, and it came back and excluded both Thomas White and Thomas Winslow. The state wasn't satisfied. They took their option and said, we want all of the evidence that has any biological material on it. We want it tested. And so they sent to the UNMC laboratory all of the evidence they had, and it all came back excluding White, Winslow, Dean. And in fact, none of the DNA from any of the six defendants was on any piece of that evidence. And at that time, the new county attorney, Randy Rittenour, in Gage County, knew that he had big problems. What do you do? Well, he was very smart. He contacted Attorney General Bruning, who did absolutely the right thing, said, I'm going to create a state task force. I'm going to bring the best people that I have in Nebraska, best law enforcement officers, and we're going to take a new look at this case. We're not going to rely on any findings from any previous investigators or participants. And in fact, they went through and determined that there was a wrongful conviction, that these six people could not have been involved. And what happened was they first tried, when the DNA evidence came back and excluded the six defendants, they tried to put the profile into the database, the state and federal database, and didn't come up with anything. But then they went back to their preserved evidence that they had from the suspects originally back in 1985, and they did have a match with Bruce Allen Smith. And then everything fit together, because the profiles, the criminal profiles created not only by the FBI, which was a very lengthy, detailed profile, as well as the one created by Dr. Wayne Price, the police psychologist, all looked and said this crime was most likely created by a single perpetrator. It was created for a sexual motive, not a robbery motive, which had been used at trial. And at that time, you know, after the state task force finding, the next step was the pardon procedure, and that was held on January 26th, where the state of Nebraska and the three constitutional officers granted pardons to five of the six. Joe White did not get a pardon, and the reason he didn't is because the district judge in Gage County vacated his criminal conviction, ordered him a new trial. The state dismissed all charges, so he had the judicial equivalent of a pardon. This is, at this point, is where the Nebraska Innocence Project got involved. We had been following the case. We'd been hoping for the best. But at this time, we got involved, and we went looking for someone to sponsor a compensation statute. And we were very fortunate to find Senator Kent Rogert. He agreed to sponsor it along with Amanda McGill. And together, they sponsored the Nebraska Claims for Wrongful Conviction and Imprisonment Act. Okay, that bill passed the legislature on April 3rd and was signed by the governor on April 8th. In its final form, it's different than what we proposed it, but we are grateful to Senator Rogert and especially to Senator Lathrop, who did a lot of the legal work, that the state now recognizes the tort of wrongful conviction, that these six individuals, if they so choose, can file a tort claim claiming they've been wrongfully convicted, and they have the ability to recover upon proper proof of both innocence and damages. They have the possibility of recovering up to $500,000 for their wrongful convictions.
So in closing, our mission is pretty clear, we feel. As the Nebraska Innocence Project, of course, we want to work to exonerate the innocent, to educate the public about the need for that, and as a result, to reform the criminal justice system. We are a small group. We're a young group. It is a group comprised of very passionate people, social scientists, attorneys, students, volunteering their time. And I'm the newest to the board, so I get to say how proud I am to join this group, because it was already a group that had started and gotten its momentum together when I joined. And I've continued to be so impressed with the work that's been done by this organization. Our work right now is focused on the state of Nebraska for those who feel they've been wrongfully convicted, who are completely innocent of the charges, and who have either existing DNA evidence or hopes of collecting DNA evidence. There are other state organizations, for example, the Midwest Innocence Project, seated in Kansas City, who take on cases that do not include DNA evidence. They do both, with DNA evidence and without. And we're working to get the word out. The Mississippi Innocence Project has John Grisham, the novelist, on their board. So when Jeannie Burke finishes her novel, we'll have that notoriety as well. But until that time comes, we want to educate the public about the work that we feel passionate about and our hopes of helping those who sincerely and truly have that help owed to them.
This is just a word to let you know that we do have both a webpage and a telephone number for anyone that's interested in contacting or learning more of the organization. Our web address is nebraskaip.org, and the telephone number is 341-7954. So thank you.
So, ladies, thank you so very much. You may have a chair now for the remainder of the program. We have some 12, 13 minutes left to go, and we have a lot of questions. And first of all, I'd like to find out how Nebraska Innocence Project is funded.
There's two primary sources for our funding. The first would be individual benefactors. We have several members of our community that believe in our mission that have come forward with generous gifts. And the second, we would be funded through grants, through community civic grants, government grants.
And we're also trying to do fundraisers. We're hoping, if anybody knows John Grisham, to get him to cross state lines and come to Nebraska, do a fundraiser
Wouldn't
for
us. Wouldn't that
be great? It would be great.
Have the Beatrice Six responded with anger as to what happened to them? I think that they would be unbelievably bitter, this person writes. Is this true?
Well, I can speak to the two people who I've met, both White and Winslow, and then Jeannie knows the others better. Both of those gentlemen have worked hard not to be bitter. That was one of the biggest things that impressed me in meeting them and talking with them. They are soft-spoken men. They are men who are trying to get their lives moving in a good direction now and are trying to deal with the atrocity that occurred, but to also have some semblance of normalcy. And they both know they have to let go a lot of that anger in order to be able to heal and move forward. But it's a tough road.
I'd have to echo the same for the other four. I've picked up no animosity or anger from Mr. Dean or from Ms. Taylor. Deb Sheldon and Kathy Gonzalez, they are both quieter. They've said less to the press. They would kind of like not to be contacted a lot and be left to their own, but no animosity or anger that I've picked up.
What about the prosecutors in the case? Have any of them come forward to talk about the fact that they were erroneous in prosecuting to conviction these people, or what do you hear from them?
There have been several statements made by former Gage County attorney Richard Smith. He sees that he did nothing wrong, and legally that may be the correct thing because he offered plea agreements. They're offered all the time. He offered reduced sentences to those who are willing to confess and testify. And so he's always maintained that he did nothing wrong. And the attorney general has criticized him as a prosecutor. And the attorney general has also severely criticized the investigators, Mr. Searcy, Mr. Stevens, and talked about bullying tactics and others.
What about the defense attorneys? Do they feel that they maybe didn't do a proper job, or what? And were they primarily county employees, or were they privately funded attorneys?
They were speaking for Joe White's counsel. They were court-appointed attorneys. They were private practitioners, Tony Redmond and Alan Stoller. I personally have had an opportunity to read the 1,000-plus page bill of exceptions of the trial from beginning to end, and I don't see any major trial errors committed. They vigorously cross-examined the accomplice witnesses. They brought out all of the major inconsistencies. They brought out the mental illnesses of several of the people. They asked for special jury instructions that were denied. I think it would be hard to prove that Joe White didn't have competent counsel. I think he very much did. The one area in the lawyering that's been criticized is the fact that some of the lawyers who represented those who pled showed their clients' statements by other defendants, so that, say, for instance, James Dean's attorney may have shown, and it's reported that he did show, Dean Ada Joanne Taylor's statement and the other statements. And so that reinforced what the story was, what they were to testify, made everybody on the same page. That practice has been discredited and criticized.
What kind of a follow-up has there been, if any, to the others involved in the cases? You talked about attorneys. How about the police, the investigators, judges, lab workers? Were a lot of them incompetent, or was it just a... Tell us a little more about that background, if you would.
I think it is the mission of the Nebraska Innocence Project, and we've discussed this at length, that we're not out to pass judgment on any of these actors, these state actors. Let the lawsuits be filed. Let the fact finders, be them judges or juries, make the decisions. What we will say that may have gone on with the investigative team is a sense of having tunnel vision. It's, I think, quite obvious that Detective Searcy believed the statement Lisa Brown made at the very beginning about Ada Joanne Taylor and a guy named Lobo, who was later known to be Mr. White, were involved in the crime. And he proceeded with that theory from, you know, day one that he became involved in 1985 all the way through 1989. And they call that tunnel vision, where they're not looking at the broader scope, not considering other things. As far as there was no crime error or forensic errors created by the state of Nebraska, those were created down in Oklahoma City. You would hope today, if they had a strong suspect like Bruce Allen Smith, that they might do if the quantity of the biological material was there, that they would do a retesting to verify the secretor, non-secretor, et cetera. But
based on recent news about a Douglas County investigator, was Douglas County involved in this? Did they freelance any of their people down to this case?
No, I believe the only contribution that Douglas County made, that there were several law enforcement officers and CSI people assigned to the state task force that Attorney General John Bruning appointed to help out with the case. But Douglas County was no way involved back in 1989 when the wrongful
convictions. In other words, Mr. Kofod was not involved.
Mm-mm.
Okay. Let's talk about the six people themselves. There's reference to the fact that at least one of them had a record, a criminal record. How many of the six did, and to what extent, and what kinds of records did they carry?
As we said, Mr. Winslow did have a felony conviction at the time he was wrongfully convicted for the assault and robbery on the Lincoln Motel. I have read police reports. I know that Mr. White had been charged with disorderly conduct, but that charge was ultimately dismissed and he was never prosecuted for that. And I'm not aware, I'm aware of reading a lot of police reports where the police came out and met with Ada Joanne Taylor and there had been fights and different disorderly conduct type of things. I'm not aware of any other criminal charges against any of the others.
Karen, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I look at it from a jury perspective, and the question in my mind, if you know Jeannie, is was it made known to the jury in White's trial that there was some criminal background before this charge? Do you know?
I believe that was nowhere in the trial.
Okay. Because that would have mattered to the jury. I mean,
sure.
A lot of times, I've talked to thousands of jurors over the years, and all it draws me to conclude is that jurors are really trying hard to do the right thing, not that jurors screw up that often. But it's also human nature on a jury, if you know some of that prior information, to think, well, if he could have done this, then he probably was guilty in the Beatrice Six murder. Or if the Beatrice Six were to say, or several of them said, as they did in their plea agreements, that they did commit the crime. If the jury heard about that, that also allows the jury to fill in the gaps and conclude this must be the right thing, is to convict Mr. White.
All six were convicted, but their sentences varied from 5 years to, what was it, 19 years? How, explain this.
It's the nature of the plea bargain and what we call incentivized testimony. Richard Smith, the former Gage County attorney, admitted that he did this. He said that there are six people involved with this crime, and he looked for those who were less culpable to work to help convict those who were more culpable. And so what you have is your accomplices who testified. Actually, all of them testified. Deb Sheldon testified, James Dean testified, Kathy Gonzalez, all three minor players. They were the ones that, in exchange for their plea agreements and for agreeing to testify, they would receive reduced charges. They had aiding and abetting charges, and they were told they would get 10-year sentences but probably do no more than five. Just for the record, I will say that Kathy Gonzalez, even though she testified, she did not testify to any of the events of the crime that occurred that evening. She merely testified that she knew Joe White, that they had one time talked about committing a robbery, but she gave no testimony as to the details of the crime. Now, the other more culpable suspects in Gage County Attorney Smith's mind were Ada Joanne Taylor, Winslow, and White. Ada Joanne Taylor agreed to plead. She pled to second-degree murder, and she was told that she would serve 15 years, and that was the recommendation of the Gage County attorney. The judge said no. The judge said, according to your testimony, you put a pillow over Miss Wilson's head. You suffocated her. She got 40 years. And then Thomas Winslow, he pled after Joe White was convicted, and he was sentenced to 50 years. Joe White, of course, was sentenced to life. He went to trial, found guilty, and sentenced to life.
One thing I would also add about Ada Joanne Taylor is that it's been reported that she was told during the questioning phase that the goal was for her to be the first woman put to death in the state of Nebraska. So those were the kinds of things she was facing and trying to determine what to do in her plea agreement.
Who made that statement?
I don't recall who it was. Do you recall who it was, Jeannie?
It was Ada Joanne Taylor.
Who made the statement to her?
I believe it was Investigator Searcy and Investigator Stevens that said, you best cooperate with us and tell us what we want, or you'll be the first woman to be electrocuted in Nebraska.
Talk, if you will, a little bit about the, is it LB 260 that supposedly will provide compensation for these six people? What's the status of it?
The bill was introduced in January by Senator Kent Rogert, and it was marked as a priority bill. And as it went in, it asked that the wrongfully convicted person be compensated up to $50,000 per year for every year in jail. Also allowed for additional, for instance, if they'd been physically injured or suffered a disability while in jail, they could have received additional damages. It allowed for attorney fees, et cetera. It was passed, it was marked as a priority bill, went to general file, and after passing general file, it was largely rewritten. Senator Steve Lathrop, in consultation with the other lawmakers, with the Nebraska County Attorneys Association, the governor, et cetera, determined that the way the statute, the law needed to be written was as a state tort claim. So it was written no longer as a legal procedure to go to court, but one where you would file a state tort claim that would be considered by the tort claim board, denied, then filed in the county where, as a lawsuit filed in the county where the wrongful conviction occurred. And under the law as passed, what the person has to do is they first file the claim, which we know will be pretty much automatically denied, then file the lawsuit down in Gage County. At that time, they have the wrongful conviction, the exoneree or the person wrongfully conviction, has the burden of proof to show by clear and convincing evidence that they are innocent of the crimes for which they were charged and convicted. And also, and this will affect several of them, if they falsely confessed, gave false testimony, they have to make a showing by clear and convincing evidence that their admissions, confessions, testimony, etc., was coerced by law enforcement.
So in other words, they have to prove their innocence all over again.
They have to reprove their innocence, which you know, Nebraska Innocence Project, we tried and tried to work with the lawmakers not to make that requirement. But to the defense of the lawmakers, you know, Senator Lathrop and Senator Robert both told me, this legislation goes beyond. It's not special legislation. It goes beyond the Beatrice Six. And the state prosecutors were very concerned that there would be defendants who were let off on a technicality. And one of them was suggested was Jeremy Sheets, who was let off on a technicality, and they did not want people who had been let off on a legal technicality and whose convictions had been reversed to be able to come back and receive compensation under the statute.
So briefly, has the case been reopened to look for the guilty party or parties? Yeah. You know?
It's been the state task force conclusively determined beyond all doubt that this crime was committed by a sole perpetrator, Bruce Allen Smith, who died of AIDS in an Oklahoma City jail back in 1992.
Okay, thank you very much. Our sincere thanks to Dr. Karen Lisko and Jean Burke, directors of the Nebraska Innocence Project. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a talk by attorney Jean Burke and Dr. Karen Lisko, the directors of the Nebraska Innocence Project. The topic of their presentation was the Beatrice Six. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, May 21st, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, June 18th at 12 noon. The topic at that time will be movie making in the Midlands. The guest speaker will be Kathy Rocco, the Omaha Film Commissioner. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.